What needs to be fixed in the world? What needs to be fixed in the world? You're gonna get one answer this morning. What needs to be fixed in the world? And I'll give you 8 seconds to come up with your answer. Something brilliant. What needs to be fixed in the world? And then we'll take a survey. What needs to be fixed in the world? All right, John? Death needs to be fixed in the world. Such an interesting response. Because then you have to think about, well, in what ways are we promoting it? But death is a big category. Was it Mike?
The DMV.
The DMV needs to be fixed. And those are the two biggies. Death and the DMV. If anyone is looking for one of those million-seller Amazon paperback books, I just gave you the title, Death in the DMV. I think that's pretty good. Yeah, Beth, what you got?
Fear.
Fear needs to be fixed in the world, meaning that we need a world in which there is no occasion for fear. Anything like that? That's interesting. Yeah.
Our hearts
need to be fixed in the world. That's a nice answer, because that's kind of like, well, let the change start with me sort of thing, right? It's like, presumably if we collectively were able to change on the inside, there would be some fantastic changes on the outside. I don't know if like we could overwhelm the DMV, but but maybe death. Yeah. Okay. Hate needs to be fixed in the world. That's so interesting, right? Boy, that is a word that gets thrown around a lot these days, you know? There are a lot of people hating on haters. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a fairly decent way to sum up culture right now. So that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, and it makes me think, well, what's the opposite of hate? You might think love. Yeah, or fear, or acceptance, or something like that. Who was it? Was it Nalani?
Oh, the family.
The family needs to be fixed. Yeah, meaning that if you could just have a good, healthy, loving, powerful family, then that would do a lot for the larger world, if we would all just take care of the fam. Was it Kenny Ray who had a hand?
Yeah.
Same. Values. Yeah. Identity needs to be fixed. Wow, so that's the start of a longer conversation, right? Because how do you identify, what are you identifying with? And so, something about the way we talk and think about identity is screwed up, though. That what would that do if that were fixed? That'd be interesting. Okay.
The universal church.
The universal church needs to be fixed. I kind of like that response, because it's like, the church has been the number one change agent in the world for millennia now. Wherever the church has taken root, good things have happened for societies. And so if the universal church, the capital C church, was really healthy and really strong, then that would sort of start a cascade of further healthy changes. That's the idea. All right, one more. Who's got the best answer? Okay, what you got?
I don't know if this is the best. I'm sorry to go here, but
government needs to be fixed. Government needs to be fixed. Primarily the DMV. But what is the government except the DMV at scale? Yeah. I feel like I've preached my sermon. Yeah. What do you love about the world? Love me. Yeah. Me, you love yourself. That about sums it up. Yeah, hiya.
Nature.
Yeah, that's interesting. A lot of people love nature because it's beautiful. I love nature, but I think it's so broken. I think it's so savage and twisted. Yeah, Margaret, you get the last answer.
Potential for change.
what you love about the world is the potential for change. That's interesting because it does seem like the world is, dare I use the word, evolving, right? And that's one of the constants on Earth, that it's changing all the time. We go through eons and seasons and developments, and it seems like it's headed somewhere. And that's a lovely thing. That's a beautiful thing. I like that. That's a good one to end on. I think there's something in most people that that hope for change, and one of the things that makes us hope for change is that we think there's something worth changing, which is to say something worth saving, something worth restoring, right? Something worth fixing up. There are so many philosophies and perspectives on life and the world, but perhaps the one that I find myself flowing in most often is just the sense that the world is a beautiful and heartbreaking place. You know, it desperately needs to be saved. It desperately needs to be redeemed and needs to be restored. And there are some things in the context of life in the world that just seem obviously wrong. And I think death is one of those things. I think the DMV is one of those things. It's like, well, this is just obviously evil. Does anybody work at the DMV? Because I feel like I'm digging a huge hole here. It's like God loves you, and you're doing God's work right on the front lines there. But I think death would be one of those things. You know, suffering. There are things that we know just seem like an affront. You know, I started this sermon series on the Book of Revelation, talking about moments of death and telling some stories. I think in that first sermon about the times in which I have held loved ones as they have died. I've done that multiple times now in the course of my life as I've gotten older. And I told a story about my grandmother, Nana, dying a few years ago. I mentioned her because a lot of people knew Nana. She was grandmother for this church for a long time. And as she was passing away, I was there home, happened to be alone with her, and I was holding her. Probably happens on occasion in those moments, I just started just speaking truth, just because I knew it was the last moments, you know, you could tell, and just apologizing for not loving her enough, not being joyful around her, because she was so joyful, and I'm kind of not. I mean, let's face it, I struggle with that, and there's just a tremendous moment of truth that happened there. Why? Well, because it was the last moment we had together in this world. And in those moments of truth, I mean, things tend to get clear. You know what I mean? Both the good things and the bad things. And it just can't gush out of you fast enough. You just want the truth to come and the things that you know to be real, to be real. We face those moments of truth from time to time. As survivors, we face those moments of truth when we lose loved ones. But of course, we'll all face that moment of truth soon enough, and when we're the ones dying, you know, and perhaps we'll be in a situation where we know, these are our last few moments right here. And I think invariably, we will have a moment of truth at that point. Things will become very, very clear for us, and pretensions will drop away, and we'll know the things that we've done well. We will know the things that we have done badly, and we will realize that maybe there were some changes undone, or maybe, hopefully, there are some changes to come in the next life. And it will be a powerful moment. You ever had one of those moments in life where you've gotten something that you've really, really longed for? I think those are rarer than those moments where you lose something that you've always wanted to keep, you know. But perhaps some of you have experienced those. I hope death is like that for me. I think in the moment of truth, that is one of the truths that I experience as I pass into the next life. I hope it feels like, finally.
Yeah.
You know, I hope it's a fist-pumping moment rather than a face-in-the-hands moment. But it will invariably be one of the two, because those moments make that happen, right? They kind of bring truth out of you. I had this powerful series of dreams once. I've told about them in sermons previously. This was when I was in a sophomore in college. I was 19 years old. And every night for 6 weeks, I died in my dreams. You've heard this story, at least some of you. Yeah, so the first night in the dream was I was being chased by somebody in a jungle. I had been preaching and they didn't like it and they were chasing me. And then eventually the group caught me and tied me up in a chair and held a gun to my face and said, "Stop preaching or I'll kill you." You know? And I realized that in the dream, my preaching had not been effective. Much like this sermon, maybe. It's like, well, nobody converted and I didn't change any lives. I was just working hard. And so the dream was like, well, am I willing to sacrifice my life for something that didn't even go that well? You know? And then the dream seemed to stretch for hours. You ever had one of those dreams that seemed to go all night long? But the entirety of it was me staring at the gun barrel, thinking this through. It's like, wow, I mean, it didn't even work, man. I got to give my life for this futility. And then, but there was only one answer, right? Like, I couldn't say, oh, I'm going to stop preaching Jesus. I couldn't say that. So I said, go ahead and shoot. And he shot me. And then I woke up just all exhausted and drenched in sweat. And then that happened every night. The same dream, the only variation was that every night I died a different way. So some nights I was pushed off a cliff. Some nights I was thrown out of a plane. I was lit on fire. I was exploded with a bomb. I was sawn in two. I was hanged. I was decapitated. I was crucified. And one night I was crucified and decapitated. Like every night for 6 weeks. And it got so that I just started making jokes about it. It sort of, I mean, you're thinking, ah, now I understand you. That's what you're thinking. But toward the end of that series, I think I'd been machine gunned apart in this particular dream. And I was lying in the sand, yeah. And I was lying in the sand, dead, and my spirit left my body. And then I rose up and I could look down and see my body lying there. All these dreams were realer than real. You know, it was one of those dreams where you're like, oh, this must be a dream. It was like, no, this is happening. And my spirit came out of my body and I lifted up to heaven and I passed some sort of barrier. I couldn't see it, but I knew that I had passed it. And then I was in a different realm. And then I was like, finally, and then I woke up. I've experienced death a bunch of times in different ways, you know, holding it and regretting it or having to sacrifice things that made me feel like I was dying or practice dying in my dreams. What I haven't experienced yet is what's to come, right? I just kind of have a taste of it, right? And one of the ways in which I taste it is that I know this is wrong, right? It feels like a system that's broken. I mean, I can see the beauty in it, but I also see that there's something wrong about it. And I just long for it to be fixed. I long for it to be restored. And that's really what the book of Revelation is about. The book of Revelation, as we've been going through it, this is the last week, is about the larger reality that is behind the curtain, that this life is not all there is. The bulk of the book of Revelation tells Christians that the world is trying to kill them, that the world is a lying cult trying to control you and destroy you, and that your job, if you want to get saved, is to overcome the world. You have to resist everything that the world throws at you, even unto death. And there's a lot in the book of Revelation about being killed for preaching, about being a martyr and stuff like that. So that series of dreams that I had was sort of a Revelation type of series. Our job is to overcome the world system. We make it by overcoming the world, by beating the world, which doesn't mean acing the world. It doesn't mean like transcending everything and doing everything really well, you know, and having the best relationships and the best financial portfolio and living in the best place and having, you know, the healthiest this and the healthiest, that's not what it means. It means preaching Jesus unto death, no matter what, whatever sacrifice it requires. And then at the end, Revelation makes a certain turn toward the end of the book, we have seen, and then it's about restoring the world. It's about how the world gets restored. It's about how Jesus comes back. And the world's like, now the gloves are off, we're going to destroy you. And Jesus goes, nope, beats the forces of the beast, beats the forces of Satan, beats the forces of the corrupt world system. And then finally, the world gets restored. Last week we read the verse from Luke chapter 9, Jesus has said many things that prefigured the book of Revelation. He spoke them earlier in the Gospels. One of the things he said that is best known is, "For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will save it." And that's the book of Revelation in a nutshell. Today I want to read from a couple passages from the very end of the book of Revelation. We'll read from chapter an excerpt from chapter 21 and chapter 22. Chapter 22 is the last chapter. And this is about it's about the restoration. It's about the end game. It's about what happened. It's about the "oh, finally" type moment that we have. Do we have slides or no? You'll have to listen when I read because we're having technical problems with the slide deck. Or you could open your Bibles. I'm just saying. Back in the day, people read things. They like opened, you know, we had these things called books. They weren't digital, they were heavy. You carried them around in a backpack and it hurt your shoulders.
That's right.
So I'm going to read from Revelation 21, verses 1 through 8 first. And the drama is basically over at this point. Jesus has won. And those who have resisted the world to death, they've won. And John, who is having this grand open vision that gets recorded in the book of Revelation, he writes this: "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea." Bad news for surfers and sailors, but this is, as we've said all along, a very symbolic book. And the sea in the Bible always represents chaos or unruliness. So this is a very symbolic way to say, finally, order on the earth. "I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband." Throughout a good chunk of the book of Revelation, the evil world system has been represented by the city of Babylon, a very symbolic city. So as a counterpoint to that, the orderly, godly system that comes with restoration is presented as Jerusalem. And this is the new Jerusalem. It's a special city, not like you know, the literal city of Jerusalem that exists currently, but this is like, think of it as the collective works of God, only perfectly ordered and restored. And John kind of sees that symbolically descending from heaven. "And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Now the dwelling of God is with men and women, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God.'" That is almost a direct quote from the book of Genesis and Exodus. There's this recurring promise in the Old Testament. God says to the Israelites, "You will be my people, and I will be your God." This is a relationship, right? Not like with other gods that was just service and slavery and fear. It's like, no. We're going to be Ohana, essentially. And he says that again here. "Now the dwelling of God is with you guys." And I just want to point out that there's probably an error in popular mythology. The great restoration has come. It's not that we all get swept up to the heavenlies and sort of live in the clouds. That's actually not what the book says. What the book says is that heaven, the order of heaven comes to earth, and earth gets fixed. That's the promise. Earth gets fixed. It's as we always knew it should be, right? All of that gets restored. And God dwells here now. That's what happens. It's a lovely restoration. And I frankly like that better. I like the idea of a fixed world more than I like the idea of a cloud condo. And the highlight of this is that God now walks with us. "He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain or DMV. I added that last one, but in the spirit of things, I feel like, I mean, it's presumed there'll be no more crying, no more tears. So of course, no more bureaucracy. But But no more death, no pain, for the old order of things has passed away. And this is what Christians have been praying for 2,000 years. Lord, let your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. This is exactly what Jesus taught us to pray. And this is the fulfillment of countless millions of Christian prayers over the millennia. The order of heaven coming to earth. The city of heaven coming to earth. Kingdom of heaven coming to earth. What Jesus has done, what he did in the Gospels with his healing and his deliverance, his miracles, his truth, his love, that was just a sample of the order of heaven. He who was seated on the throne said, I am making everything new. Then he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. He said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega. I'm A and Z, essentially, is what that means in the Greek alphabet. The beginning and the end. To him who is thirsty, I will give to drink without cost from the spring of the water of life. And this is the water of life that Jesus spoke of to the Samaritan woman, right? All of this is fulfillment of things that Jesus said. If you're thirsty, you should ask of me, and I have water that will permanently cure your thirst. He who overcomes will inherit all this, and I will be his God, and he will be my child. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters, and all liars, their place will be in the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. So that's the final judgment, right? That's the second round. Like, we all die, and then depending on what we did in this life, we may die permanently. Or we may get the sort of restoration on the fixed earth. And there's the book has said a lot about this final judgment now. This is just sort of a statement of exclusion. Who's going to get excluded? Well, number one is the cowards, which I just find so interesting. But because you don't necessarily think of cowardice as a really big sin, a big moral failure, but the entire book of Revelation has been about overcoming the world, right? It's been about facing death for the sake of Jesus. And what's the first thing that you need to pull that off? Well, courage, the sort of faith that we call courage. You know, faith has different manifestations, but that's number one. The best sermon I ever heard on faith was preached by my son Jeremiah when he was 6 years old at the dinner table. One night, he got this look on his face, as he did sometime, and out of nowhere said, Dad, I think faith is close to brave. I was like, that's brilliant. Clearly, you're going to be a better preacher than I am. But that's where it starts. And somehow, like, I don't know, he was thinking hard about it. It's something he heard in Sunday school. I don't know what it was. But even, you know, out of the mouth of babes, right? So if you're cowardly, you are in trouble. You're going to need courage. The unbelieving, well, that kind of makes sense. If you don't hold on to the truth, you're dead, literally. The vile, I don't even know what that means. But there's some like, you're twisted. You're twisting things. I think that's what the Greek means literally. The murderers, yeah. The sexually immoral, well, yeah, we have to be careful with sexuality, don't we? Those who practice magic arts, and there was a lot of that in those days, but like false spirituality, false religion, stuff like that. The idolaters, and all liars. I don't know, that's kind of sobering because none of us are innocent, right? This is why we need forgiveness. And their place will be in the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death, the permanent one. I didn't want to skip from there to the beginning of chapter 22. I'm just going to read the first five verses because this further describes the restoration of the earth that's to come. But to me, it kind of paints a restoration of Eden. Using a lot of the same symbols, which sort of tells you that there was an original design that we broke, But the Lord, through this epic drama that's been going on with humanity these countless millennia, has restored it and has taken us back to where we need to go. Only now, we're capable of making better choices because we know how to resist, don't we? That's what the book of Revelation has been about. And then the angel of the Lord showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb being Jesus, we've determined, down the middle of the great street of the city. So imagine this New Jerusalem, and down the main avenue, you know, like H1, is all this river of life, all this glorious water, right down the middle of everything. On each side of the river stood the tree of life. Well, there's the tree of life. But notice that it's just the tree of life. No more is there a tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You know, the tree of life versus the knowledge of the tree of good and evil, that was the opposition in the book of Genesis. It was like, choose life, or if you think you need to go figure it out on your own, go for it. And Eve and eventually Adam was like, oh, yes, we're going to go our own way. Like, you know, individual rights. I don't know what they said, but they justified it to themselves and they went off on this road of distrusting the ways of God, and we've all experienced it now. Now that tree is gone, and now there's just the tree of life there, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. No tree does that, but this tree is perpetually fruitful. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations, literally the healing of the ethne, the healing of all peoples everywhere, is what that means. No longer will there be any cursed. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will serve him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their forehead. So once again, we're walking with God in the garden. They will not need the light of a lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord will give them light. They need no illumination but their trust in God. And they will reign forever and ever. And this is the other thing that I want to stress. We'll end with this, is that we don't just get to glorify God forever. We just don't just get to submit to him forever. We get to reign with him. And I don't know exactly what that means, but we let the earth get out of control the first time, right? This time around with this earth, we get to reign over the earth. It's like we get to tend it. We get to steward it. We get to create something. I don't know exactly what it means to reign with God, to reign with Jesus forever, but it's a job, right? There's something to do, which I like a lot better than the idea of just, you know, sitting in a room and singing glories at God all the time. I mean, great. Love to sing. Awesome. After about 1,000 years, that would get boring, I think. But what the Bible promises us is a life of creativity that we've always wanted but have never known. Right? We get to reign over the earth, so we get to put right anything we need to put right. I wish I had that power today, but I'm probably not wise enough to pull it off yet. Right? But ultimately, I will be, because I'll be illuminated by the very presence of God. There'll be healing for anything that needs healed, because I will have access to the tree. And then I'll just read these couple of verses just for fun. And then the angel said to me, these words are trustworthy, true. The Lord, the God of the spirits of the prophets, sent his angel to show his servants the things that must soon take place. And then with a few more attestations, the book of Revelation ends. But it ends with just the angel kind of getting in John's face and saying, this is true. This is true. And the book ends with kind of this moment of truth. Like, we've seen all of these things in this grand vision, and then the angel of the Lord comes to us and say, are you willing to buy it? Are you willing to go for it? Are you willing to accept this as true? It may well cost you everything, because the world is trying to kill you. The world is trying to kill you. All right? Are you willing? Like, even if somebody sticks a gun in your face and says, stop, are you willing to believe in it so much that you would die to overcome the world? And so at the end, the angel says, it's true. This is your moment of truth. Buy it. Make the choice, right? Because in those moments, the truth tends to come out. We'll all have that moment of death. We'll all have that moment of judgment where everything just becomes incredibly clear. I don't know how best to end a sermon series on the book of Revelation, but I kind of like the way that the book wraps up with just the picture of what every soul knows ought to be. I don't think there's anyone on earth that doesn't know that things ought to be different. And I don't think there's anyone on earth who rejects so much of the world that we know that we think that none of it should be restored. Many people are willing to burn it down just out of hate and spite, but we all have our loves and affections. There is an earth, and there is an order of being that I desperately want to see at this point. I mean, I desperately want a world where there's no death. Desperately. Can't stand it. Cannot stand death. Can't stand it in any form. I don't like to see the people I love dying. I don't like to watch it on the news. I can't even kill animals. Can't eat them. I just find it so offensive. Death is just so incredibly wrong, and we all kind of know it. You know, I long to see a world where that's fixed. I long to see a world where people aren't sad and lonely. You know, I've done this ministry bit a long time. I've been in this game a long time. Sadness overwhelms people to the point of death. You know, I've had some suicides around here recently. People just get sad. There's an absence of love and joy that I want to see fixed. I know it's out there, guys. I just know it's out there. I long for it with all of my being. I also know that there's an alternative out there, that without restoration and redemption and the work of the Lord, things can get hellishly bad. I see it a lot in the world. I experience it a lot in the world. I mean, it seems to me in this world that liars typically triumph, that murderers typically get away with it. People mistreat people all the time. And I know that it's going to take some judgment to fix that. You know, that there are some things that need to be stopped dramatically. There's an assertion in the book that there is a good restoration ahead. You know, and the angel gets in John's face and says, and it's true. This is trustworthy. This is the one thing in your existence that you want to trust, John. Tell everybody. That there's a restoration available to anyone if they're just willing to overcome. Oh, it might be hard. The whole book says it's going to be hard, but it's available to anyone who wants to overcome. And then we're just left at the end with this moment of truth. Now, you're all going to have moments of truth in your life. You might have one today, right? Today might be like, are you in or are you out? Stop wasting time. Stop it. Don't let the world control you anymore. Like, you have to decide. Otherwise, the world is going to get you. The beast is going to get you. You know, what city do you want to belong to? Babylon or Jerusalem? Symbolically speaking. Maybe some of you are facing moments of truth and just, you know, decisions, things that you need to let go of for Jesus. You know, are you going to be sad and angry about that forever, or are you going to let it go, forgive, and move on? This is a moment of truth. And I think if Jesus were standing next to you, you know what he would say. So just stop with the stuttering, right? Because you know what Jesus would say. Yeah. And there's some of you, I think, are just really sad. And if you can overcome cowardice and unbelief and lies, maybe you'll start to feel a little joy and freedom in your heart. Maybe you'll start to feel more like an overcomer than a loser. They're often oddly linked, people. He who wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will save it, right? It's often in the losing that we feel oddly victorious. All sorts of moments of truth going on out there, what I'm saying. But more than anything else, what I'm saying is embrace them. Embrace them. We are people of moments of truth. That's kind of what we do. That's our stock in trade, moments of truth. We make decisions. Ultimately, we all have to, sometimes with a gun in our face, sometimes with a broken heart. But you all have to make decisions. What is it going to be? What is it going to be? And that's where the book ends. You know, what's it going to be? What truth do you want to go for today, I guess is my question. That's a good way to end the sermon series on the book of Revelation. What truth do you want to go with? Let's just pray together for a minute. All over the world for thousands of years, people have been deciding how to live their lives. But everybody who decides how to live their life always decides how to live their life in the face of something. Nobody makes these decisions in a vacuum. Nobody makes these decisions without pressures and temptations and promises and lies to sort through. It's never completely simple. But ultimately, we have to boil it down anyway. In the name of Jesus, brothers and sisters, I just bless you with that age-old tradition of making a decision. In Christ's name, amen.